You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. This episode is made in partnership with Accenture. And today, it's all about the need for speed. I can still remember the excitement of the first time I brought my groceries online, clicking and waiting just 72 hours for my shopping to arrive. But today in London, it's possible to get a delivery to your home in 10 minutes, quicker than if I ran to my local convenience store and did the shopping myself. This is the world of quick commerce, mind-bendingly rapid processing and delivery. If you've ever wondered how this sector works and what it might look like in the future, this is the episode for you. Can a sustainable service be built on a model where pickers, drivers, and processing staff have to rush orders to customers in the time it takes to make a decent cup of tea? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by somebody who can offer us some proper insight on this topic. Matt Jeffers has many achievements to his name, not least launching Tesco.com in China. He's now Managing Director of Retail Strategy at Accenture. Welcome to Table Talk, Matt.
Hi, Stefan. Good to be with you again.
It's an absolute joy to have you back with us. Let's start with the origins of quick commerce. Where in the world did it begin and why has it found a foothold in the UK?
So, I mean, quick commerce itself has been around for quite a few years. It's picked up a lot more in the last few years, especially over two decades ago. It started in the States. Also, at the same time, there was rival companies in China as well starting it up. Customers always wanted to be able to get access to the products that they wanted. And so rapid delivery service made sense. And also we had things like restaurant services where people were able to order, take out and be able to get food delivered relatively quickly. So not too much of a surprise that people started to leap to grocery services as well.
So the market here has been expanding very rapidly. Are there particular parts of the country where quick commerce has taken off more than others? I mean, I presume cities, but who is the target consumer in those cities?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, logically, it makes sense for these types of services to be in highly urban areas, so lots of people around to be able to, that are living close to each other. So you can provide these types of services, 10 minutes, 15 minute type delivery services, because they live close enough to the shop or the store where the people are picking the items and be able to get it out to the customers. So typically London being a logical place for that, but also the other metropolitan cities across the UK. The target customer though is really interesting. The customers who've ended up using the service tend to be 18 to 30 year olds. So either a combination of students or young professionals who are living relatively fast-paced lives. They are typically the type of customers who would go to convenience stores, whether those be the supermarkets or the local convenience stores, to be able to get their items. They're starting to replace those daily or every other day type missions with using these online services. Doesn't mean to say that you or I, Stefan, wouldn't be able to use this service. Of course we would. There might be missions where you're running out of items at the end of the week, or you might be having something like a dinner party, a party where all of a sudden you run out of ice, you run out of alcohol. That's exactly, the service is created for that type of mission to work really well.
Yeah. So it's really interesting that you say that, because I think there's some perception that people that use quick commerce are lazy, can't be bothered to get down the shops. But you're saying the opposite, that these are people with fast-paced lives that are busy and that have so much going on that it's an extra tool to allow them to be busy.
There might be the odd customer who is maybe slightly lazier and is just trying to be able to tap into the service, particularly whether they are, gamers are one sector who tend to be identified that are tapping into this type of service. But for the most part, I think it is those customers who are just trying to make the best use of their time in the right way. More importantly, they're willing to pay a little bit extra for that convenience. They're not doing a big shop. They're doing a relatively small shop. So the total spend that they're partaking in, relatively small, and they're willing to pay a little bit extra per item to be able to get it delivered to them.
So that's interesting. So if we move on from the consumer to the companies that are making those small gains, I guess, It's strange, isn't it? Because there are many companies in this sector, and loads have been established just in the past couple of years. And that's no coincidence. You know, we've had the pandemic, which has really shifted consumer behaviour. I mean, immense behavioural change. But is that behaviour now an unbreakable habit? Has the pandemic started something that is really almost set in stone, that things are delivered rather than us going and mixing with the dirty public out there that you might find in the shop?
So I think, first of all, from a supply side, obviously, you're right, a number of companies have sprouted up over the last couple of years, and some of those have come into the UK from elsewhere. So they've started in the US, started somewhere in continental Europe, and have moved into the UK. It doesn't really cost that much to be able to set up these businesses in the first place. As long as you can get supply of the foodstuffs, the wholesale players who will be able to provide the ingredients for you, and then you're tapping in to effectively the gig economy to try and get the riders, the pickers, essentially, to be able to come and get the items for you. So that's relatively straightforward to be able to set up these businesses. But the challenge then is getting the consumers to be able to come and shop with you. And the first thing you have to do is be able to acquire those customers, and you have to get them to stay.
And to break the habits and the connections that they already have in order to do that as well. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Exactly. So one of the easiest ways to do it is actually to bribe people. Now, it's not bribes, typical bribes. It is just saying, I'm willing to give you 10, 15 pounds off your first order if you come in and shop with me. Now, that makes sense. And of course, all of a sudden, if you're saying, well, I'm only going to spend £30 and you're giving me £15 off, that sounds like a great deal. So everything that you said at the top there, so kind of the time it takes to be able to go to the shop, and you're giving it to me for half price. Why would I not partake in that type of service? Yeah. But then you need to keep that going. You need to be able to make sure that habit sticks. And so some of those offers are not just a discount off the first order. It might be discount off your first three, four, five orders and spread throughout that time. And in general, what we find is that if you do shop for that number of shops with one provider, the habit starts to stick a little bit more because you get used to it.
Yeah.
You understand what products you can get, and you're varying what's in the basket. It's more than just one single mission that because it's raining outside, you're actually saying, actually, this is really useful. I'm going to keep going. The big question is whether when you take subsidies away, will that habit stick? And that, I think, is what we're waiting to see whether that happens, because so many companies in the UK now are still adopting that tactic, and we started to see consolidation in the market. Some are dropping out of the market because they simply can't keep going at the same pace. A number of companies have come together in terms of acquisitions that we've seen in the last few months, and now the question will be, as you consolidate, does that mean that the few players that are left in the market, that they will drop the acquisition costs, drop retention costs, and they'll just start offering regular services. And they'll only invest in the marketing money if customers are seen to be leaving their services. Rather than just getting them to keep shopping with you, they'll look for people who are lapsing. And then they'll say, all right, Stefan seems to be lapsing, I'm going to send him an offer to get him to come back and shop with me. At the moment, it seems like it's just good money thrown after bad, and they're keeping spending that money to be able to perpetuate this. And I think that's where there's a lot of doubts in the market from a lot of the research analysts and some of the industry players to boot, that they think this is not going to last unless you keep the subsidies going or something else changes about the business model.
And this is where it gets fascinating. So presumably, you have to throw enough money at consumers until they affect some kind of lifestyle change so that they begin to rely on the speed of it, and which is very different, and that maybe they wrap their lives around it. It's the way that they begin to make food or plan less. But that takes time, doesn't it? And that's what's extraordinary. So can we dig into the model a little bit more then, both logistically and financially? First of all, how does a company get your groceries to you in just 10 minutes, which is extraordinary? But also, is it a model, as you've hinted at, that is financially viable?
So let's talk about logistics first. I think when you understand the logistics, then you start to understand a bit about why the finances are so tricky with this model. So most of the services are 10 or 15 minutes to be able to get the groceries. So you place your order, typically through an app, most of the businesses tend to have a range of about 2,000 to 3,000 products available. And it's deliberately relatively small, so they can fit it in a relatively small store.
Yeah.
Also, it can be quick enough to be able to pick the order. So the order comes in from the app. Most of the companies will have dedicated pickers within the store, and that store will be close to you, obviously, to be able to get the delivery out to you. That person will run around, pick it as quickly as possible. That order will be handed to a delivery driver, or really a rider in this sense, because most of the deliveries are going out on e-bikes. And then that rider will then get the order to you as quickly as possible. So you typically only have about 2 minutes to pick the order, something along those lines, a minute transition, 5-6 minutes to be able to get it out, cycle up the road as quickly as you possibly can, and then hand it over to the customer to hit that 10-minute window.
And presumably to be able to hit those timelines, you've got to have redundancy built into this. At 7 p.m., when there's a rush of orders, you need to have 10 staff waiting, so you can't ever have somebody messing with that 10 minutes. That must be phenomenally expensive.
So it is expensive, and typically what most of the players do is that they have people on hourly wages. So sometimes those people will be busy, and you're getting the best use out of paying for those hourly wages. But at other times, the shoulder periods, so maybe it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon before it gets busy, or later on in the evening, you clearly don't need as many people. Mm. So you do want to be paying an hourly wage and using analytics to be smart about understanding exactly what does the profile of each night look like. Clearly, certain nights in the week, Friday, Saturday night, tend to be much busier than other nights. Mm. You also want to have an eye on things like the weather. Because not only will the weather affect what's happening from the customer perspective, it can also give you some challenges around being able to get around. So in wet and tricky conditions, riders may take a little bit longer to be able to get to the customer.
Yeah.
Interestingly, before we move on to the finances, one of the things is we've seen that people are saying we need to extend the customer value proposition, and doing it in 10 minutes may be a little bit too much. And so softening of the messaging that's going out to say, we're going to deliver it to you, Stefan, in minutes, rather than being specific about 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
Could mean 100 minutes.
Could mean 100 minutes. I think in general, people are realizing, all right, actually 10 minutes versus 15 minutes, that doesn't really matter too much. It just takes a bit of pressure off the rider to be able to get it to you in time, also staying safe on the road at the same time.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, there must be a lot of pressure to get there blooming quickly, and that's a dangerous tool to use, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's pressure on the riders to be able to get out there at the same time. Some, but not all, of the players will pay the riders based on the number of deliveries they do, as well as their hourly wage as well. So you'll get a certain amount of fees. You may also get a tip if you're dealing with generous customers on top of that. So it's in the rider's interest to try and get out, do the delivery, hit the timeline, get back, pick up another one, head out again. It's no surprise that the riders are pretty tired by the end of the night, despite the fact that they're buzzing around on these e-bikes to make it a little bit easier for them.
Yeah. So those are the tricky elements to it. Presumably the upside is that you don't need to run a shop on an expensive high street, and the savings come from that sort of area. Are there other benefits to the companies themselves from this model?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think because of the times that we live in and where those people are located that want to access these services, they are still going for high street locations or close to high street locations where they're locating these little mini warehouses. Mm. A lot of businesses have unfortunately gone to the wall in the last couple of years. It means that there's relatively cheap space available in these urban or semi-urban locations, which means they can locate a store, relatively small store, you know, we're talking about 3,000 square foot, something of that order or smaller, to be able to get out to customers. Mm. And so they're accessing cheaper property. These companies are benefiting from a number of other reasons, being able to get access to some of the CPGs to be able to understand how to be able to get the products in. So working directly with the manufacturers and striking deals. As they build up scale, they can get products a little bit cheaper. They can also understand the customer and think about how do we monetize the ability to, we've got an 18 to 30 customer base.
Yeah.
How can we think about targeting them in a slightly different way? Is there a way to be able to monetize that essentially by sending them advertising, etc.? So lots of ancillary revenue streams that are possible. But the key thing, coming back to the finance side, is so much of the of money is spent on getting delivery out to the consumers. If your typical basket size is about £20, and remember 70% of that will be spent on just paying for the goods in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? So you've only got 30% left to play with. And if you work the way through the maths, you're making a very, very small profit just on the operations before you pay for any marketing costs, before you pay for any fixed costs. That just means the economics are really, really hard to be able to make a profit. So all of those subsidies we were talking about before, those happen after that. And so you can understand how delicate the finances truly are in this business model.
It sounds more than delicate. It sounds, I'm on a scale of madness rather than sort of feasibility. So what is the funding model? Is anyone yet making a profit?
So there are companies around the world that are making some money off this. Those companies are saying that they're making money in certain cities or certain towns. And there are a number of reasons why they might be doing that. They might be the only game in town. Mm. They might be in a location where the rent is truly cheap, but also the labor model works in their favor. So good example, GoPuff in the US have talked about the fact that in certain university towns, they've been able to tap into not only a captive consumer base in terms of people who want to buy the products, but also students who want to earn some extra money and will be willing to sign up to be able to be the riders to get the products out to consumers. It works quite well in that sense. Mm. But actually, where people have been making more profits are in markets where the labor is just that much cheaper. And so the ability to be able to get the products out to consumers, you're paying a fraction of the cost that you pay in the UK for your riders. And it may also be that you're not employing the riders as well. And that's a key point here. Back to what you mentioned earlier, if you need to have a certain number of staff at a certain point, and you're paying them an hourly wage, it's a lot of people to have in your business. If you can tap into a gig economy where those people are not your employees and you really are paying on a per delivery model, much more efficient for these companies to be able to do it. So you've seen that in places like Southeast Asia, East Asian countries, where these models, not only are they popular and profitable, there's a question mark over whether they become the predominant model of how you'll be able to tap into groceries getting delivered, because these countries don't necessarily have next day delivery that we've had for 20 years plus from the likes of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Ocado, etc. here. So it's a relatively new service. And all of a sudden, again, you're back to the point of, well, hold on, if I can get it delivered, I don't need to plan and get it delivered in 15 minutes. Why would I not do that? I don't want to sit and spend a long time planning out my weekly shop. Again, time will tell whether that actually happens, but certainly a number of clients of ours are starting to worry in these emerging markets where they're saying, yeah, there's something about this model. Maybe we need to embrace this as a supermarket. That this is the model that we need to go to the market with.
That's really interesting. I guess also as well, it's a data rich business model where you know you're not just selling something to somebody and plotting what they've bought and what they need, which a lot of supermarkets can do anyway, but you've got the timing of that and the specifics and a small basket which is really clear about that. Once you have that data, you can market to that data, I guess, and that's an advantage as well. But so once you get these ideas of an advantage, then you can get why it's an exciting area. But what is on a big scale the prize for investors? Why do so many companies seem to be following a model that doesn't make much financial sense at the moment? There must be an end game, the sunlit uplands of quick commerce. What is that likely to be, do you think?
So I think the hope of a number of investors that are going into this market, and several of them have invested now a lot of money. So we're talking billions of dollars have gone into e-commerce over the last little while. Their hope is that one or two of these companies is a winner-takes-all situation where they get carve out a chunk of the market where they can say, all right, we're the only game in town. And that only really works when it's one or two companies. When you have five or 10 companies, as we've had operating in the London market for the last little while, it doesn't work because it's so easy for you or I or anyone to switch between the different providers. If you've only got one or two, then all of a sudden you don't want to spend as much marketing money to be able to get the customers in. Mm-hmm. You start to have a model which is more sustainable. You can also start to think about some more solid financial steps in terms of things like premium pricing being in place. At the moment, you pay a little bit more for these products, but it's not always consistent in terms of what the premium would be that you pay for. But actually, if you were to say it's 30% more than you would pay in a typical supermarket, is that too much of a premium to pay? Maybe for some customers it might be. For others, they'll say, actually, that sounds about right. That's probably what I'm paying in my local convenience store. So that's actually fine. And when you have those types of levers to play with, Stefan, you've got a chance of being able to get to a model which is a little bit more sustainable. Mm-hmm. I think also just playing around the edges with things like the minimum order values, the higher that is, the better you have getting to a cash profit at the end. Of course, the challenge there is the more items you're adding into the basket, then it's going to take longer to be able to pick it, and you can't get it to the customer in 10 minutes. And so then you're thinking, well, should I try to drive them towards more expensive items? So if it's alcohol, for example, you're trying to get them to buy things that are more expensive, so into wine, into spirits, etc. And it's all to be learned over the next couple of years, using some fairly sophisticated analytics, understanding how customers are reacting, maybe getting some support from the Alcobev companies, as an example, to say, why don't we test and trial some things and see if we do some targeted marketing at particular times, maybe that will help us improve the overall economics. And so getting the improvement in the overall basket size plus some additional marketing support from the companies coming in, all of a sudden you've got a fighting chance, I think, of getting to a model that works. The one additional point, of course, is that a lot of these investors from the outside are realizing that we've got a new generation of customers coming through. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that we want to have a way to be able to tap into this generation of customers. We don't think that other companies are doing it quite as well. Q-commerce gives us a chance. And because we've got a closed mechanism through apps, we can send them targeted advertising. We can understand a little bit more about their buying behavior. It's all a closed loop. We can learn very quickly about exactly what this consumer group is doing and be able to react to that in quite an agile way.
I guess what we're pointing out really is that at some point it's not sustainable to have, as you say, this many companies. Then there'll be presumably a period of consolidation or maybe just people going to the wall and leaving behind the winners. Now, lots of these quick commerce companies are really bullish about their prospects, though, and their potential to expand. I mean, is that confidence well-founded? How far can it go?
Yeah, I think that they can continue to expand, particularly at the moment when there is still, for now, relatively cheap capital available in the market to be able to keep investing in there. Mm. But they do need to start putting in place some of those levers to think about how they can make the model more sustainable. So we've mentioned some of the stuff around premium pricing, some of the elements around playing around with the basket size, trying to drive that higher. Mm. Also thinking about what can they do behind the scenes to be able to try and reduce the cost. And now a lot of money in the grocery world is being spent on things like automation at the moment. And typically speaking, that does work relatively well when you're doing big basket shopping. You can have large automated facilities or even medium-sized automated facilities where it makes sense. It's harder to prove the case when you've got a much smaller facility and just the amount of capital you would need to have to be able to put an automated solution into these warerooms in urban centers. You just need so many of them. Mm. That might be something that comes in time. There's a number of companies that are investing to try and build solutions that will work for that. But it's delivery is the key thing. Again, remember we said so much of the cost of getting this out to the consumers is ultimately in the delivery cost. So what could be done to be able to drive down that cost in time? Things like autonomous vehicles all of a sudden will take out the labor costs. And that is an interesting one.
Yeah.
Of course, some challenges there, because it's already enough of a challenge when you've got people riding vehicles around on the, whether it be on the streets, on the pavements, etc. Things like e-scooters at the moment causing lots of challenges. But when you move to all of a sudden having autonomous vehicles, then we need to think about how do we regulate that in the right way. And although there's trials going on both here in the UK and across the world, it's not yet clear exactly what that will look like. And of course, an autonomous vehicle only takes you so far, because you might get to the garden gate, but actually the vehicle can't get into the person's house. In urban locations, often people are in flats, and so that vehicle can't get in, can't get into the flat, can't go up in the elevator, can't go upstairs, etc. So customers would have to come down to the pavement to be able to get the items. All of these things, in terms of regulation, getting across some of the logistical barriers, may just mean it's a little bit harder to do. It's probably a few years away from that becoming commonplace. I think by the end of the decade, we'll see much more of that. For now, it's much more focus on things that you have within your control, hook consolidation in the market, play around with some of the economics to get better deals for the consumers. And then in time, more sustainable models will come, because you'll start to be able to erode some of those delivery costs away.
But as you say, I think you're right. It takes a lot of time, because that's about regulatory change and things like that for autonomous vehicles. So that's the changes that and the tweaks that the businesses can make. What about consumers? You've mentioned quite a few things already. Is there anything else, any other enticements that could be offered to customers? I mean, beyond the delivery speed, which, as you say, they're kind of thinking, well, maybe 15 minutes, maybe we just say minutes. Possible, targeting consumers much more strongly. Then maybe you can give freebies away. But then any company could do that, really. What else can you entice the consumer with?
So you can start to think about other services that we could provide to consumers. So obviously at the moment, Q-commerce is all built around the fact that we have products available, we can deliver it to the consumers in a relatively quick time. There may be options to start thinking about the local community as a whole. We have a number of riders that are there, we're paying them an hourly wage. Can we sweat that asset more effectively and be able to go around and do other types of delivery service? Because we have the people available, we could be able to do that. So rather than thinking of it as Q-commerce, that's where I go to get my food products quickly, actually it's any products or any services that could be done by somebody else for me in a relatively short period of time. That starts to take you down a model of saying, well, would I pay individually for those services? Would I start to think about subscription models where I know I can tap into that? I can get a certain number of deliveries done over the course of a week or a month, for example. And it just plays on that idea again of taking some of the hassle factors away from consumers, and they could be able to tap into that. I think closer to home, Stefan, there's probably elements around thinking about bundled items or things that are exclusives that are going to be a little bit different for consumers to be able to tap into. A lot of the companies, I think, probably hope that they can start to do more own label or maybe a little bit more personalized types of products that they'd be able to get to customers. Really, it's not personalized, it's more mass customized products that you'd be able to get out. But there could be collaborations with companies to be able to get products out that are more things like breakfast or lunch or dinner, where it's a meal solution, again, picked up from a local area, or it could be that you keep it within your store to be able to get it out to the customer. It's thinking through what are those micro moments where the consumer is at home, on the way home from work, thinking through, I need to be able to get something done. Can I do that for the consumer? And can I take the hassle factor away from them by providing that service to them?
Hello there, only me. I just wanted to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out Matt's previous appearance on the podcast, where we spoke about how grocery retailers are adapting to life after lockdown. Just go to foodmatterslive.com and search Grocery, What's the Recipe for Future Success? And now, back to the chat. So what can we learn from the global view of quick commerce? Because outside the UK, quick commerce is big business. China has a market that's a few years ahead of us. Labour laws obviously very different there, regulation very different. But what can we learn from Chinese quick commerce, or I guess from any other parts of the world where it's become not the norm, but certainly become a force?
Yeah, exactly. So China's been doing this for a number of years. And actually, what's interesting in some ways that it's not quite gone full circle, but what they've learned there is actually that consumers are not the same at all times. And so they actually want to be able to tap into an array of direct-to-consumer services, if you like. So it might be that today it's raining outside, I don't have the time or inclination to be able to go to the shop, so I want to tap into Q-commerce. Tomorrow, I'm actually thinking a little bit further ahead. I have a bit more time on my hands. I do want to plan out and be able to get things delivered and have a £100 shop coming in. And so what they've started to see now, much more in the way of a full service offering. So what I care about is I want to service you as my customer and lock you into my ecosystem. And I've got an array of different services you can tap into if you want it quick. Fine, we can get it to you quick, and that'll still be in a relatively small number of products. If you want something fuller in terms of the total basket size, we can do that as well. And maybe that comes from a different facility, but I've got you within the ecosystem. And so it becomes much more economical because I'm not trying to attract you as a new customer. I'm not paying lots of marketing money, but they've got ways to be able to get there.
Yeah.
I think the flip side in terms of the negatives is, although the labor rules are different, they've learned that actually there's a lot more sense in being able to try and get a workforce that comes and works for you for a longer period of time. You invest money in the training of the drivers, making sure that you get the right quality of service. I said I know from experience of working in China, it can be hugely variable in terms of the quality you get of working with delivery partners. The more money you invest in having your own workforce, being able to get them trained up in the right way, dealing with customers in the right way, that means you've got a better chance of being able to get the customers to come back. And particularly if something goes wrong, they know how to be able to deal with it. And so that's something, again, that companies here are starting to work a little bit more on, despite the fact there's a lot of churn and rotation around the different drivers across the different companies. Actually, getting those drivers to stay with you means you don't need to train them again. You've got a loyal customer base and a loyal driver base. All of a sudden, you've got something in there that can actually work for the long term.
Thank God you started mentioning things like loyalty, and it was a relief to move away from the sweat the gig economy model and to actually say, well, we need good people and we need to train them and pay them properly, I guess. So that's quite exciting. Now, what you've brought up by mentioning this sort of twist in China, where they're trying to do a whole model where you do the big shops that maybe are next day delivery as well as the 15 minutes. This brings in the whole concept of the big retailers here in the UK, because this is both a challenge and opportunity. Now, presumably, Ocado or Tesco's or anyone could actually add this on to what they do. They can have smaller fulfillment centres around that only do a small bunch of things. They've already got the concept. They've got the data and the consumer base.
Yeah, and so the good news is that they're already doing it to an extent. They haven't built up huge numbers through these business models, but Tesco, Sainsbury's have got Chop Chop, which is an app-based service to be able to get rapid delivery. It's not 10 minutes. But it is typically 30 minutes to an hour that you'll get your products delivered. Ocado had the same through Zoom. The challenge that the shops have, or certainly something like Ocado has, is that their main model is built around large centralized fulfillment centers, which are close to some customers, but certainly not close to all customers. And so it's much harder for them to be able to do it unless they invest in new facilities in the same way that the QCOM players are doing. And that is indeed exactly what these businesses are starting to do now. They're either taking the same sorts of facilities, maybe slightly larger in urban areas, and trying to use those to be able to get out to customers typically within an hour, or they're trying to use their stores and sweat the assets in the stores. Obviously, it doesn't apply to Ocado, but for Tesco, Sainsbury's, etc., that's exactly what they can do.
Yeah.
And either they use their own workforce, or they're working with delivery partners to be able to get those orders out to customers. That's one way that they're approaching it. The other way is to use people like Deliveroo and Uber Eats, who obviously, again, already have a platform that works very well to be able to get to customers, been working very well from a restaurant and food service perspective. And now in the last few years, that's extended much more into being able to get groceries out to customers. One of the challenges there, of course, is that that's not selling through your own platform. That is selling through somebody else's platform. So if you go with an aggregator, you get the benefit of the eyeballs of all those consumers. They obviously may be in a mode where they were initially going thinking, well, I'm actually going to get some food for takeout. But at the same time, they realize the option to be able to get groceries, and you get a sale of groceries that you weren't expecting to get necessarily. So you're not paying for the acquisition of those customers. Great. But you're not getting necessarily all the information about those customers. You don't know exactly who it is. Mm-hmm. You obviously still have some of the costs because you're typically picking the items within your stores before you hand it over to the Uber Eats or the delivery driver and passing it off to them. But it's still a viable route to market, at least to be able to test and trial. And actually, long term, I think those businesses may have a better chance of survival than a lot of the QCOM players. Because remember, they've got the restaurant and the food service side, as well as groceries at the same time. And so one of the predominant models I expect to see over the next couple of years is some of the supermarkets doubling down with these providers and saying, let's do this together. Let's come up with a model that works, that benefits both of us. We've got to work out the economics again to make sure it makes sense for both of us. But this is a model that can actually work. And then that sits nicely against their full basket shop that they're typically doing, which is next day. Even though at the same time, I think next day will become same day a little bit more, and the supermarkets will all say, we need to be better at doing full basket shop on the same day. Still requires planning from the customers, etc. But I suspect that's where they will go, thinking more about convenience, immediacy for customers. That's going to become paramount.
Yeah. So in your opinion, I mean, as you've explained, this is a really complex market, lots of very complex forces and risks as well for the different companies, that there might only be a handful of winners and people are going to go by the wayside. Do you see quick commerce breaking the stranglehold of the big supermarkets? And are they going to gain significant, useful market share?
I think for the time being, they will continue to eat into the overall grocery pie. Now, remember, they are not necessarily just competing against the big supermarkets. They're also competing against the local convenience stores.
Mm.
We're not necessarily eating more food, although during COVID times, we did spend more on groceries per household. That was just because we couldn't go out. We were all spending more money at home.
Mm.
But generally speaking, we're not necessarily consuming more. Of course, we'll have things like inflation, which means we're spending more money. But actually, the QCOM missions are competing against local convenience stores as well as the supermarkets. It'll continue to eat into that and take a chunk of that market out. But then we'll start to see the supermarkets retaliate a little bit more, as we've been alluding to. I think long term, there will be space in the market for a couple of players to be in there providing these rapid services. They'll have to adapt the economics of the model, as we've talked about. But there's enough space in there and enough demand coming through from consumers that they will say, yes, I want to continue to pay for that type of service. But it's not going to become the predominant model of getting your groceries. I think still most customers will stick with the model that they've had for a long, long period of time of relatively large baskets of products coming through. That is still more economic. You're paying less for the products. You're paying relatively little for your delivery costs, but you do need to spend a bit of time planning to be able to get those items ordered. Maybe there'll be more investments in helping people do that in a rapid way. So using smarter artificial intelligence to be able to predict what does Stefan need this week for his full basket shop. Almost all the supermarkets do that already. I would argue they do a pretty good job, but they can't be there with you. They can't see exactly what you're consuming. They don't know exactly what you bought last week, how much you've eaten of that. But with smarter devices on your fridge, being able to understand what you've had, maybe cameras in the home, all of these different things coming together, that should take away some of the hassle factor of big basket shopping and make it a little bit easier. So all things being equal, there's a place in the market for Q-commerce, for sure. They've proven that so far, not just in the UK, but elsewhere. But it's not going to become the predominant model, and there's only space for a couple of players.
So you've summed it up pretty clearly there, but you know, to sum up, quick commerce here to stay, but looks like it's going to evolve a little bit in the future, and that is, there's a few question marks about how that unfolds.
Exactly right. I think if we think about what happens next, I expect there'll be some more consolidation in the market for sure. In the UK, the newer players may not be able to survive because it is becoming increasingly cutthroat. And they just need to adapt the model to be able to survive effectively. It just can't keep going. Once that money goes away from the VCs and the equity money that's flooding in, all of a sudden the model just doesn't stand in its own right. And they've got to adapt the model to be able to have something sustainable for the long term.
Fantastic insight. Matt, thank you so much for telling us all about Q-commerce.
You're welcome. It's a great topic. It's an interesting sector to work in, for sure. And let's see what happens.
Excellent. So you've been listening to the Managing Director of Retail Strategy at Accenture, Matt Jeffers. Now, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Table Talk podcast, brought to you in partnership with Accenture. If you did, we've now published more than 200 editions exploring the whole landscape of the food industry. Just go to foodmatterslive.com and search for the topic you want to explore. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.